HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Eggland's Best.
I'm Wendy Gillette. There are new negotiations underway to try to free the hostages in Gaza. Correspondent Remy Innocencio is in Tel Aviv.
For the first time, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu acknowledged Israel has restarted hostage talks with Qatar and have engaged Egypt just days after his war cabinet said no. Now, that development came late Saturday night as thousands of people assembled here at Hostage Square, where I am in Tel Aviv, demanding the government do something, anything, to get the rest of the hostages still in Gaza home. Now,
lawmakers are still trying to get a deal on an immigration package that also includes war funding. CBS's Matt Piper reports.
A deal would bring two priorities for President Biden: funding for Ukraine and Israel. Also tied to the funding, security at the U.S.-Mexico border, something Republicans say they want to see in the package. The Senate is delaying its holiday break, which had been due to start this past Friday, and could convene as soon as Monday to give negotiators time to reach an agreement.
Turning to the GOP race for president, a new CBS News poll shows Nikki Haley is gaining on former President Trump in New Hampshire, though he continues to dominate in Iowa. Those surveyed ranked Haley as the most likable and reasonable candidate. A powerful storm is moving up the East Coast. National Weather Service meteorologist Zach Taylor.
For portions of Florida, as well as along coastal South Carolina and North Carolina, there could be some strong damaging winds or perhaps even an isolated tornado as this area of low pressure lifts through the region.
Girls are more likely to contract HIV. Here's CBS's Stacey Lynn.
According to a recent study by UNICEF, girls are twice as likely to get it than boys. Nearly 98,000 adolescent girls were infected with HIV in 2022 alone. They say the data suggests that gender inequality, limited access to healthcare, and a lack of educational programs are to blame.
71% of new infections in adolescents are among girls, even as HIV prevention and treatments have made significant gains. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas on the roads and in the sky, correspondent Elise Preston reports.
Crowded airports and holiday gatherings are also leading to a rise in COVID and flu cases. Nationwide, influenza cases are up 10% from a week ago. California also had a 40% jump in COVID hospitalizations. But the pandemic is also helping create a longer holiday season. Remote workers with greater job flexibility are beginning trips sooner and ending later, on average, adding 6 days to their travels.
This is CBS News.
Eggland's Best, the only eggs with more fresh and delicious taste, plus superior nutrition, because the way we care is anything but ordinary. Only Eggland's Best.
I'm Dr. Stork. Eggs are a staple in our diets, and there's only one egg with more delicious farm fresh taste plus superior nutrition. Eggland's Best. With more vitamins, including 6 times more vitamin D and 10 times more vitamin E, plus 25% less saturated fat than ordinary eggs. Available in so many delicious varieties. Classic, cage-free, and organic. Eggland's Best. Better taste, better nutrition, better eggs.
Inspired by real events, the 6th and final season of the acclaimed fictional Netflix drama The Crown is now streaming. Prince William tries to integrate back into life at Eton in the wake of his mother's death as the monarchy has to ride the wave of public opinion. As she reaches her golden jubilee, the Queen reflects on the future of the monarchy with the marriage of Charles and Camilla and the beginnings of a new royal fairy tale in William and Kate. All episodes are now streaming, only on Netflix.
People are maybe not keeping up as much as they should be on some of those new tactics.
Only 28% of the quiz respondents answered most questions correctly. Ann Clem acknowledges a lot of people don't have time to research the latest warnings, but she says scammers prey on busy schedules this time of year. For online shopping, she suggests looking up the company name with the words scam and fraud to see if concerns pop up in the internet search. And when shopping at brick-and-mortar stores, Ann Clem says getting gift cards requires some extra attention.
It's just making sure that gift cards haven't been tampered with before you purchase it. You can see the PIN number on the back when it should be covered and stuff like that.
Other tips include being suspicious of huge discounts on hot gift items, especially when they're promoted on social media. And if you plan to travel this holiday season, AARP suggests being wary of websites pretending to be legitimate hotels, airlines, and other related businesses. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Plenty of clouds out there for today. Some patchy fog early. We'll see a slight chance of some sprinkles, maybe some flurries in the late day. Temperatures holding steady in the upper 30s. West winds. Tonight, a chance of some light snow and flurries. Currently 35 degrees.
From Lake Wissota State Park and the Pablo Center, the entire Chippewa Valley is tapping in to the station talking about your hometown. 93.5, The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
UAUK.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning, and thank you for joining me and my wonderful producer, Anya, for this, our second hour of our Saturday morning broadcast. We're talking all about accountability and deterrence this morning, and that continues into this second hour when we chat with you, as always, discuss with you always the significant news events, the occurrences in our lives in the area of government and rule of law, and yes, the aspiration for justice in America. In our first hour, talking about the ways in which different defendants, civil and criminal, have responded to the judgments entered against them and the lessons pulled from them about not only their specific behavior, but the lessons conveyed to all of us in America about the results of conduct that is contrary not only to the laws of our nation, both the civil and criminal laws, but also to our basic understandings about how we behave in a society of people where we live together in a community, expecting behavior that is respectful of all of us. We're going to continue with many of those themes in this, our second hour, and always much appreciative, both Anya and I are, of your calls and your text questions as well. And we've got a couple of those. I'm going to take them right at the top of this second hour. We've got an unidentified individual who texted in a certain comment, a question really, about this issue related to Rudy Giuliani and the imposition of this huge monetary verdict against him for defamation. Wondering aloud, as our listener texter states, whether or not the law clerk to Justice Arthur Engoron, who is the judge who's presiding over the civil fraud case in New York City, could one day bring a defamation lawsuit against Donald Trump for the things that Donald Trump has said about her. And we recall well that the particular statements that he made without any foundation, which, yes, indeed, is an initial predicate for a defamation case, no foundation, factually untrue. We would sometimes call those lies in common parlance. He told the lie that somehow this particular law clerk to Justice or Judge Engoron was having a relationship of some kind with the majority leader in the House and the Senate, rather, Chuck Schumer, completely unfounded, based upon a photograph in which the two of them were depicted. No support for them whatsoever, just the opposite. And that, of course, leads to all of this litigation, all of these appeals now going on with respect to the so-called gag order, really just an imposition of requirements upon this defendant not to engage in those kinds of things that attack court staff. And we know, of course, that the courts are in fact supporting those particular orders entered by judges to tell this defendant, Donald Trump, you cannot make these kinds of statements about court staff. Those are being supported appropriately. They are not violations of his First Amendment rights. Nothing imposed upon him that would be imposed upon any defendant. And so getting back to the question from or comment from our good texter, our listener this morning, could those statements that Donald Trump made about her form the predicate for a defamation case down the road?
The answer is yes, with a small y. Of course, you want to talk to lawyers about that. There's also got to be a certain amount of intent, as there plainly was in the Rudy Giuliani case, the knowing aspect of this, the impact of it that it could be having upon this particular law clerk. We know from reporting in that case that the law clerk and the judge, the justice there, have also been on the receiving end of huge numbers, violent comments, threats sent into the court in response to what Donald Trump said. Many, many analogies to the case involving Rudy Giuliani, false statements done with intent, done with purpose, and resulting in these huge, huge impacts upon the individual. The answer is yes. There could, in fact, be a future prosecution, all these kinds of things, underscoring the significance of the First Amendment, giving us all rights to say things, but not unfettered, not unconditional. And especially when it comes to defendants in civil and criminal cases, the obligation to abide by the fundamental tenets by which we conduct the rule of law in the courts of our nation. Appreciate that text very, very much. Appreciate also another text from Dana, who comes in from across early on in our program, is asking about the Jack Smith prosecution. In particular, Dana, appreciate your comment, your question about the possibility that our senior senator in the state of Wisconsin, Ron Johnson, might possibly be among the subjects, maybe the targets of Jack Smith in that federal case, that he is pursuing there in Washington, D.C. Right now, that case identifying just one defendant, Donald Trump, in four different counts. But plainly, the Department of Justice has indicated that there are others out there, unindicted co-conspirators identified in that indictment. Ron Johnson is not plainly among them. But we know the Deputy Attorney General, for example, has indicated that fake electors may also be within the ambit, the scope, the possibility of investigation, prosecution by the federal government, and presumably others as well. So we don't know. We don't know exactly how broad Jack Smith may pursue when it comes to other defendants in these cases, including members of Congress. But that is certainly a possibility as well. And it also leads, Dana, with my great thanks for your question, to the other issues we want to get to this morning, and which involve, actually, those prosecutions coming out of Washington, D.C., and in particular, the scope of the charge against Donald Trump and the scope of future charges that might be presented to a grand jury for return of future indictments, whether they are against members of Congress, United States senators, members of the House of Representatives, or other individuals who, like Donald Trump, allegedly were involved in violations of our federal law. We hasten, as always, to add that people indicted by a federal grand jury attend with them the presumption of innocence, and that is removed only upon a finding by a jury, a trial jury, sometimes called a pettit jury, that they have, in fact, been found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Then all of those presumptions go away. But right now, again, the singular defendant, Donald Trump, in that federal case, like the other defendants, the remaining defendants in the Georgia case, and even the defendants in the other, the New York case involving the hush money, those cases as well, that presumption of innocence still attends. What happened? What happened just this past week, again, in connection with our Supreme Court, that may have the impact upon those prosecutions, and in particular, the prosecutions coming out of the District of Columbia, that could have a great impact upon the future of those charges? Well, the Supreme Court, just on Wednesday of this week, granted certiorari, again, as we talked at the top of this hour, certiorari, this process by which the Supreme Court says, yes, indeed, we will review a decision by a lower court that has made a determination that warrants our examination, warrants our analysis. The Supreme Court made a decision on Wednesday to hear a case that could potentially, depending upon how they resolve the case, could upend the prosecution of hundreds of those rioters we talked about earlier who attacked the Capitol on January 6th, and could also delay or maybe even just limit the scope of the very prosecution that Dana and others are asking about this morning, the scope of that prosecution against Donald Trump on federal charges of trying to overturn his election defeat. At issue in this case now before the Supreme Court to be decided by the Supreme Court is whether the government, the United States Department of Justice, Jack Smith, the special counsel, can charge defendants in these cases under a federal law that makes it a crime, and this is the important language, to corruptly obstruct an official proceeding. To corruptly obstruct an official proceeding. The law is plainly at the heart of these prosecutions of many of the members of this mob that sought to undermine and block the congressional certification of President Biden's electoral victory in 2020. And significantly, it's also a key part of that federal indictment that accuses Donald Trump of plotting to remain in power, the four-count indictment against him. Now, that particular case, again, comes out of a situation involving an individual defendant named Joseph Fisher. And Joseph Fisher was indicted on seven charges for his role in the Capitol attack, just like the sentences we discussed earlier involving particular defendants. Joseph Fisher is another one of those who was present on January 6th among the rioters of that day. Prosecutors in that case say that Fisher assaulted the police as Congress was meeting, as we know, on that day to certify the results of the 2020 election. And like hundreds of other rioters at that time, their actions also disrupting the certification proceeding, Fisher was charged with obstruction of that proceeding, this obstruction count, which is also known as 18 U.S.C. Section 1512. That's the statute inside the federal criminal code that this case now before the Supreme Court is all about. Fisher sought the dismissal of that portion of the indictment brought under the obstruction law, which, interestingly, was passed as a part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002. Remember that? And the statute, and this is the reason why it's significant, was aimed principally, primarily at so-called white-collar crimes. Prosecutors traditionally, routinely have used this particular charge in lieu of more politically contentious counts like insurrection or a seditious conspiracy to describe how members of the mob disrupted the peaceful protest of presidential power. So they chose to go under this particular statute by virtue of the facts that led them to charge under the statute. There's a judge. His name is Carl Nichols. We've talked about him as well. Carl Nichols, Federal District Court in Washington, D.C., granted Mr. Fisher's motion to dismiss. He said that the law required the defendants to take some action with respect to a document, a record, or other object, something that was missing from Fisher's conduct and the Capitol. What happens is that case goes up on appeal to the district court, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia reverses that lower court decision and rules that the law applies broadly. It does, in fact, cover Fisher's conduct, applies to all forms of corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding, and that includes Mr. Fisher. And the obstruction charge there, of course, then is the subject of the review by the United States Supreme Court, whether it can be applied in that setting, but also has an implication because it's the basis for two of the four charges against Donald Trump in the very case that Dana from La Crosse you're also asking about this morning. Now, if the Supreme Court reverses that, significant consequences not only for the prosecution of those rioters, those mobsters, those folks who were part of the mob at that time, but also for the prosecution of Donald Trump. When we come back, I'll tell you more about that and the implications of another decision made by the Supreme Court just this past week to review another case in the life and livelihood of all Americans.
The Tap, the Devil's Advocates radio show.
Dane County Executive Joe Parisi. Joe, let me ask you, you've made a little news. You have declared what in regard to the Twitter, now known as the X, and the Dane County municipal accounts. Joe, have you banned Twitter?
Well, we're no longer going to be using Twitter, I think is probably the...
Is that the same as banning Twitter, sir?
The Devil's Advocates radio show.
Weekday afternoons from 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Ask Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
Earl Ingram was giving Thanksgiving turkey cooking tips. Apparently, if you use your thumb and put an imprint on the turkey breast, if it bounces back, it's fresh. If it doesn't, it's frozen.
If you see a guy wandering around a grocery store in Madison doing things to turkeys, you'll know who it is.
I just gotta find myself a freshie.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
And we are back. Thank you once again for joining me for our discussion this morning of United States Supreme Court again. In connection with its decision to take one, actually two cases this past week that have dramatic impacts upon our lives here in America, talking right now about this decision to review the scope of this case involving this individual named Joseph Fisher, one of the rioters, the people who were part of the mob at the Capitol on January 6th, but also has implications not only for his case, but also for many other cases charged against other individuals, also the subject of trials and convictions based upon this particular statute, and arguably even more important, two of the counts in the federal indictment against Donald Trump pending in the district court, pending in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan right now, are also premised upon that same theory under 18 U.S.C. 1512, this notion of obstruction of justice and the mechanisms under which this particular statute would be used to not only charge but also present evidence during the course of the trial. If indeed the United States Supreme Court determines that the statute is inapplicable not only to Fisher but also to Trump, what would the impact of that? Well, you could, in fact, go back and re-indict many of those individuals. With respect to Donald Trump, it does not completely remove the all of the charges in that indictment. There are two others that are not dependent on that particular statute. One of them accuses Donald Trump of conspiring to defraud the United States by using the lies that he told that the election had been stolen from him. And the other charges him with plotting to deprive millions of Americans of their right to vote. So those charges would remain. We do not know exactly what the Supreme Court will do, but a huge case in terms of what the Supreme Court is going to be deciding probably in May, maybe June of this year, going to be hearing arguments, going to be soliciting those briefs about what the scope of this particular statute is, could have an impact not only upon the prosecution of the former president, which is pending right now, scheduled still for trial, arguably in front of Judge Chutkan for March, although she has indicated she is suspending proceedings until appeals in that case go forward, but it could also have an impact upon the future of many of these prosecutions, not all of them, many of the prosecutions of the rioters themselves on January 6th. There was and there is a second decision made by the United States Supreme Court, again, on Wednesday of just this past week, in an entirely different area, but it also moves us into the discussion which we promised to resume today about the attack upon our agencies and upon the notion that there are experts inside our agencies who know what they're doing, but whose beliefs, whose results of their own analyses, their expertise are being questioned by not only federal judges, but by people in our public domain, even one running for president. Let's back into that by identifying exactly what happened again in the Supreme Court just this past Wednesday. The Supreme Court announced again just this past week that it's going to decide on the availability of this commonly used abortion pill. It's called mifepristone. We have talked a lot about it in the past. It's a major case involving abortion on its docket since the time of its decision in Dobbs of a term prior just to this one. At the time when the court issued its major decision, Dobbs, finding that the Constitution, the federal Constitution, does not convey a privacy right to women to
an abortion in America under the terms, the language, the meaning of the Constitution, reversing 50 years of understanding of what the Constitution does, in fact, say about that. At the time, Judge Alito wrote that this is going to be the final word from the Supreme Court about this. Well, it turns out that's not the case. The move, of course, by the Supreme Court to take this case from the Fifth Circuit reflects the failure of the court to address this issue in a way that provides clear direction. We know as a result of the decision in Dobbs that we've got all sorts of patchwork approaches now in the states throughout our nation to the abortion issue. How does this one come about? Well, we know again that early this year, in April of this year, a federal district court judge in Texas, his name is Matt Kaczmarek, found that the FDA's decision, lasting for about 25 years, about 23 years altogether, a decision based upon its analysis, its examination, its expertise, medical people, scientists, laboratory specialists, finding that mifepristone was a relatively safe drug, when it comes to the administration of abortion services, reproductive services. We recognize that no drug is completely safe, but this gets the FDA approval by the overwhelming majority, not only of FDA doctors and experts, but also by others out there. The judge in Texas identifies a couple of offbeat fringe reports out there that indicate that mifepristone is not, in fact, as safe as the FDA has certified it to be. And the judge replaces his authority, the authority rather of the FDA, for his own view about this and says, I'm going to overturn a quarter century of decision making by the FDA. I'm going to find that FDA, the approval of it, of this drug was inappropriate and prevent the further use and distribution of the drug. The case goes up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. We've talked a lot about them. And just recently, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, after having oral argument in this case, comes back with a decision, a split decision, that while it does not find that the drug is illegal, limits its access in many ways. Again, a situation which Sandra Day O'Connor talked a lot about in her case involving Casey versus Planned Parenthood, said, you know, you can't at the same time give someone a right but then prevent access to that right. That was Sandra Day O'Connor in 1992. Same kind of issue here. The Fifth Circuit says that while it's not going to find that mifepristone itself is illegally out there for distribution, medical distribution by medical doctors, it nonetheless supports many of the limitations on access to it, effectively preventing the access that you would otherwise envision premised upon the FDA's longstanding approval. That case now before the United States Supreme Court. That case going to be argued by the Supreme Court, again, returning to the Supreme Court, another issue related to abortion. A major case, again, also the subject, interestingly, of a district court decision coming out of the Eastern District of Washington State. A district court judging the same time back in April of this past year that Judge Kaczmarek out of Texas was deciding mifepristone not properly authorized by the FDA. A judge named Thomas Rice finds just the opposite. And based upon the petition of 18 attorneys general from around the state, regrettably, not including our own attorney general from the state of Wisconsin, but 18 attorneys general petition there. And the judge there says, yes, mifepristone is in fact valid. The FDA's decision-making process is in fact valid and permits that to go ahead. All of that now wrapped up inside this decision now to be rendered by the United States Supreme Court about mifepristone, about Privacy Act concerns, about privacy concerns, and how those privacy concerns in the Constitution should or should not be acknowledged by legislatures and courts and other officials in the wake of the Dobbs opinion. When we come back, we're going to talk about the other consequences of that particular decision. Again, the impact upon not relying upon the expertise of agency officials out there and the ways in which that can and is affecting right now the campaign for the presidency. Stay with us for that discussion.
Permission, did I mention? Don't pay him any attention. Cause you had your turn, now you're gonna learn what.
friend what's on tap.
There's a new station in town with conversation about Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
CBS News Brief. Thousands of Israelis demonstrated in Tel Aviv, angry about three hostages killed Friday by friendly fire. Miri Yarnoff-Sharoff was there.
Make sure that all the kidnapped are returned as soon as possible.
The Senate and White House are trying to seal a deal on immigration. CBS's Willie James Inman from Washington.
The framework would be part of a multi-billion dollar supplemental funding package that includes military aid for Israel and Ukraine. GOP lawmakers remain opposed without significant changes to immigration policy.
A new CBS News poll shows former President Trump losing ground in New Hampshire, but dominating in Iowa. Deputy Director of Elections and Surveys, Jennifer DePinto.
Trump is boosted in Iowa by an electorate where nearly half of Republican caucusgoers consider themselves part of the MAGA movement, higher than the 33% we see for primary voters in New Hampshire.
CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
Bucks win again at home. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks wasted no time to put away the struggling Detroit Pistons at Fiserv Forum. The final, Milwaukee 146, Detroit 114. It was the Pistons' 23rd loss in a row, the worst losing streak in the team's history. Pistons head coach Monty Williams on why he called a timeout early in the first quarter to chew out his players.
Rarely do I have to call a timeout and jump the group the way I did tonight. We knew this would be a tough stretch. To not have that dog grit toughness to start the game was something that I had to call the group up on.
The Bucks are now 18-7, a game and a half behind the Boston Celtics. Head coach Adrian Griffin.
I thought our entire team had the right approach coming into this game. You can never judge a team on the record. I think they got a lot of talent on that team. But I love our approach of coming in and taking care of business early. The first 5 minutes were critical. I thought we set the tone. We had just great contributions from everyone.
That's Bucks head coach Adrian Griffin. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Plenty of clouds out there for today. Some patchy fog early. We'll see a slight chance of some sprinkles, maybe some flurries in the late day. Temperatures holding steady in the upper 30s. West winds. Tonight, a chance of some light snow and flurries. Currently 35 degrees.
When I first had my baby, I'd get comments all the time about how happy I must be. I remember thinking, I want to be happy. Why don't I feel that way? It was hard to admit that, even to my doctor, but I'm glad I did. She told me it was postpartum depression, and that is very treatable. These days, things are feeling good, and we're both happier about that. Right, little man? I'll take that as a yes.
Mental health care is working for Simone. See what it can do for you at mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Your soulmate is somebody who, when you get out of the McDonald's drive-thru, she'll do a picklectomy and take the pickles out of my cheeseburger and put extra pickles on hers.
I'm flummoxed, I'm flabbergasted, I'm quacking upset right now.
You're going to defend pickles?
Except for bread and butter pickles, those things are the devil.
Oh, see, now if I were going to try any of them, it would...
Pat!
Got,
come on!
Okay. And this is why Greg and I are not married.
Weekday morning, 6 till 8.
On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
Anybody who's ever breastfed a child knows that breast milk is liquid gold. Preserve it at all costs.
Oh, that's what Kristen was talking about. Yeah. Freezing it, like pumping, freezing. She's like, I have bricks of it. I'm like, this sounds like a reboot of Breaking Bad. Like, this is...
In the breast
breaking
milk.
Breast. Breaking breast.
Breaking breast. Well done.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Brock. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Lexi spent more than 6 years in foster care.
Before I was adopted, I felt alone.
With help from the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption, Lexi now has a forever family and the foundation for a bright future.
Adoption changed me for the better. I feel like I can be whoever I want to be.
You can help find permanent homes for children still lingering in foster care. Learn more at DaveThomasFoundation.org.
You're tapped in to the issues affecting the Valley and all of Wisconsin.
Consider us the bartenders of friendly local talk.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We are back. Thank you for continuing to join me this morning as we talk about the future of America, including these cases now pending before the Supreme Court in which challenges are being made to our federal agencies, the expertise inside those federal agencies, the medical doctors, the engineers, the scientists, the educators, the economists, all of those folks who know what they're talking about and who understand based upon their education, their experience, their practical day-to-day work, the best recommendations they can make about things in our lives. This case now coming out of the Fifth Circuit, now before the Supreme Court, challenging the 25-year decision by the FDA approving mifepristone for the purposes of ensuring that women have safe access to this drug. Now challenged coming out of the district court in Texas and the Fifth Circuit, a challenge now pending before the Supreme Court and determining not only the future of that important issue in connection with privacy rights and abortion rights in America, but also even a larger issue, which we've begun to talk about in recent broadcasts, continuing now to talk about, which is this attack on what Donald Trump and others in the campaign ambit out there right now have described as the administrative state. And it is indeed, as the mifepristone case indicates, and three other cases we've talked about before also reflect a fundamental lack of confidence in and, frankly, suspicion about the experts, the people who know, the people who give us their best recommendations based once again upon their education and upon their experience, a doubt that their expertise should be followed, and instead a substitution by an all-powerful executive, perhaps also in these cases, all-powerful district court judges who supplant their judgment for that of the experts. That is a very concerning term of movement. That is a very concerning movement in the overall discussion about our relationship with the federal government. We know from our past discussions here on this broadcast and generally in the public domain that this is called an attack on what's called the administrative state, as if there are thousands, tens of thousands of people out there, unknown to Americans generally, who are doing all sorts of things without accountability, civil servants under that ambit, doing some things without the trust and the confidence of people who really know. That is not the case. The great majority of people in the civil service are reliable. They come to work every single day without political animation and do their jobs well, again, based upon their expertise. But now we have this attack by candidate Trump and others, again, not premised upon so much a disagreement about policies in the areas, for example, of environment and the economy and commerce and labor and even justice, overseas issues, all of which reasonable people can disagree about, but instead an attack upon the very ways in which government works, an attack upon the very institutions of a republic that rely fundamentally upon these agencies to do the work that Americans rely upon them to do. We talked before about these three cases. They're called Raimondo and Jarchese and CFPB. All of them, in ways large and small, now join this other case. So we have four cases now in front of the Supreme Court in which this fundamental issue about deference to experts and reliance, not unfettered reliance, a reasonable interpretation, reasonable reliance upon the expertise of these agencies, whether that should be continued. And in the CFPB case, again, alleging that the CFPB improperly constituted, appears perhaps that the Supreme Court may find in the end that the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is in fact properly put together. But in connection with another case, this Jarchese case, maybe determining that the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, not to be trusted, not to be supported in its nearly 90-year history because of the way that it is operating recently. That attack upon the SEC, also a part of this attack on the administrative state. The big one, of course, as I said before, this Raimondo case, another case called Relentless. the Supreme Court going to hear arguments in that case on January 17th, about a month from right now, determining whether or not something called the Chevron Doctrine, it's been out there for 40 years, the Chevron Doctrine should be continued to be embraced by federal judges. And what does that say? Well, it incorporates this fundamental notion that when a statute that a federal judge has to interpret is not clear, it might be silent on a particular issue, when it's not clear on a particular area, the deference is made to the people who know, the experts in our world, the people inside those agencies. Their call, not given deference without any sort of analysis, but a reasonable deference to those agencies, is a part of the Chevron Doctrine. But in Raimondo and this relentless case, that very concept is up for grabs. And the Supreme Court has indicated that it will determine whether or not that will continue to be a part of our jurisprudence going forward. The Mifepristone case, also in that general category of whether or not federal judges, arguably more broadly speaking, the government, the executive branch itself, should be substituting its view for the view of the experts in that case inside the FDA. And so all of that, a part of this attack on the administrative state, which we talked about in our previous broadcast, bringing us up to date again for our discussion here today. And that discussion necessarily includes many of us who are out there discussing these kinds of things in the public domain. As we continue to discuss all of this, wanted to comment once again that it's a part of this overall view about Project 2025 that has as its umbrella approach this notion of expanding dramatically presidential power over the very machinery of government. And yes, presumably including that of federal agencies, this attack on the administrative state, one part of that. And a part of that also this advancement of something called the unitary executive theory. As we talked before, that theory which is out there, but again, a fringe theory, at least until recently, advances this theory contrary to the language and the focus of our Constitution, that the government is composed of three separate branches with overlapping powers to check and balance each other, that theory, that fundamental notion, checks and balances, balancing of powers, is in fact inaccurate. That in fact we need to reject that instead in favor of an argument that Article 2 of the Constitution, that is the article that establishes the executive branch, gives the president virtually complete unfettered control of the executive branch and these agencies as well, so that Congress, when it establishes, for example, the CFPB, the SEC, the FDA, all these cases involving these agencies, that Congress cannot empower those agency heads to make decisions and could even restrict the president's ability to engage in oversight of those. All of those things brought inside the executive branch under this unitary executive theory being advanced by former President Trump as a part of his current campaign. We've seen that in the past, never successfully advanced, but it is a part of the articulation, a part of the articulation by the Trump campaign. The former president saying, I have an Article 2 and I have the right to do whatever I want as president. That is not the law. That is not the Constitution. And it should ring a bell, apart from the differences that we may have about policies in all these different areas. Again, in the areas of economy and overseas, our international policies, domestic policies in the areas of commerce, and yes, indeed, in medicine, in immigration, in healthcare, all these kinds of things that are so important to the future, we can have those differences. We should have reasonable differences and reasonable debates inside all of those issues. These proposals go to the very heart of how that is done. And it is the exaltation of a super executive branch under these theories, Project 2025, a unitary executive that today we're also going to discuss, again, coming out of not speculation about what the Trump campaign might be articulating, but things that Donald Trump himself is saying. And again, not to spar with him today about the substance of what he might bring to a second presidency in his present candidacy, but rather the mechanisms through which he would serve as our chief executive. Let's talk about some other aspects of this unitary executive theory that he himself has advanced from his own words and the words of his campaign. If Donald Trump wins a second term, he has said that he would use the U.S. Department of Justice to have his adversaries investigated and charged with crimes. And he has said, including saying this in June, that he would appoint, in his words, a real special prosecutor to go after President Biden and his family. Those are the words of Donald Trump using the Department of Justice as his own political, as he's used the word, retribution to go after what he has described as his adversaries. He later declared in an interview with Univision that he could, if someone challenged him politically, have that person indicted if someone challenges him politically. Now, we know, based upon our discussions in the past, that indictments, at least under our Constitution, as we presently know it, come what? From a grand jury, 26 people convened in every single district in this country. They come together, they review evidence. The question is, if indeed he is using the Department of Justice to take vengeance on his adversaries, his political adversaries, the people who do not support him, is that system in some way going to be affected by the things that he is going to do? And is he going to place people inside the Department of Justice in the role of an attorney general, deputy attorneys general, assistant attorneys general of the sort that we've seen before, who will do his bidding and instead do things that are at the encouragement and the advice and the counsel and the direction of the presidency? Now, we have talked about this concept before. It is vitally important in every single term, Republican, Democratic, whatever the term is, whatever the president is, that the Department of Justice be at arm's length from the White House. And this administration, the Biden administration, has gone to great lengths. I'm going to say that, but actually to walk that walk, making clear that it has nothing to do, for example, with not only the decision by the Department of Justice through special prosecutors, through special counsel, to indict the president's own son. Certainly the president has said he supports his son, he loves his son, but he doesn't have any involvement in that matter. He doesn't have any involvement in the continuing investigation of Joe Biden's own acquisition and maintenance of documents that he should not have. Other things are not within the ambit of the Oval Office, not in the ambit of the White House. That is as it should be. I had the great honor many years ago to serve in the Clinton administration under the administration of Janet Reno in the Department of Justice. Those two, notoriously, publicly and privately, did not get along especially well. And Janet Reno made many decisions, again, that Bill Clinton did not especially appreciate as the president of the United States of America, including commissioning a Whitewater investigation that ultimately landed in the seat of a special prosecutor that resulted ultimately in Bill Clinton's impeachment, ultimately his acquittal in the United States Senate. All of that, however, indicating how a relationship between the Department of Justice and a sitting president should be. And that is this, that when it comes to particular indictments, charges made criminally, and yes, indeed, charges made in the civil environment as well. We've seen it as well in the Department of Justice. There are many cases in the environmental area, the tax area, the civil rights area, the civil litigation area that are civil in nature. The decisions about that have got to be vested exclusively inside the Department of Justice. Why? That's where the investigations take place. That's where the U.S. attorneys and assistant U.S. attorneys throughout the country operate without partisan animus, without partisan agendas, without a political agenda to follow the facts, apply the law, present evidence before the grand juries in criminal cases, and decide on civil prosecutions based upon all that without direction from the White House. Now, when we come back, I'll tell you about the ways in which a connection between the White House and the Department of Justice can and should be pursued. And as we further discuss this issue related to the unitary executive theory in America.
I'm here.
You're listening to 93.5, The Tap.
One in four Americans today are living with a disability. I'm one of them. People with disabilities are extremely talented, resilient problem solvers that have so much to offer. And we've got a trusted ally on our side, an organization we can rely on, Easter Seals. Easter Seals is leading the way to full equity, inclusion, and access to healthcare, employment, and education for people with disabilities, families, and communities. That's my Easter Seals. Make it yours.
Learn more and get involved at EasterSeals.com.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We are back for this, our final segment of our Saturday morning broadcast, talking about the ways in which this unitary executive theory under Project 2025, if enacted in a second Trump term, would dramatically affect not only the balance of power, but change the way in which the United States of America has worked for 240 years. Talking right now about the relationship between the U.S. Department of Justice and the White House, which Donald Trump has promised to erase when it comes to the separation of responsible authorities for civil and criminal prosecution. What can a president do? A president can indeed confer with and talk with his, hers or her one day, attorney general about broad issues, focuses, for example, upon environmental issues, upon antitrust violations, upon other things related to tax violations, and all kind of international issues, environmental issues, policing issues, those broad things, the emphasis generally, those kinds of things can and should be a part of the consultations between a properly appointed attorney general who understands her or his responsibilities and the White House. What cannot and should not happen is specific decision-making, even inside those broad categories of focus about who is indicted, who is charged criminally and civilly. And that's the problem with what Donald Trump is proposing when it comes to his attempt, his articulated intention to erase that distinction between the Department of Justice and the White House, to go after his adversaries, to dictate what the Department of Justice will do when it comes to criminal prosecution and presumably even civil prosecution as well. As always, we appreciate your callers. Joe, we appreciate your calling in this morning. Thank you for hanging on the line with me this morning. Your comment, your question about our subject matter this morning.
It's really fascinating show, and I so appreciate the detail that you supplied. I wanted to return to an issue that you had in the first hour, but it certainly pertains to what's going on with your discussion about the unitary executive, and particularly the climate of kind of, you know, campaign of fear that that Trump has put forth. My question is this: the amount of money, punitive damages that the jury awarded the two women election workers. Gigantic. It was
it
a large
gigantic.
Amount of money.
Yes.
Apparent. Right. Yeah, even the judge was surprised at it. And
yes.
My question from that is, does this kind of open up a door? And the reason why I say that is that attention has focused on these two women, but all sorts of election workers, poll workers, and Secretary of State, all sorts of people have been put under this kind of threat and terror by individual people who are doing this at the behest of what Trump has told them. So you have, for example, people calling up in Vermont saying, this might be a good time for you to put an effing pistol in your effing mouth and pull the trigger. These kinds, or your days may be effing numbered. I mean, it is a clear, in the words of one lawyer, and you've been saying the same thing throughout this time, the damage of living with a threat hanging over you. There's damage to that. You're afraid. You make choices in your life based on that threat. So if you've got Trump, and there's plenty of examples, but I'll give you one. He was in Georgia, Valdosta, Georgia, in I believe it was September, replaying footage from a very right-wing group called, what is the name of it? It was One America Now, and basically urging his supporters to not attack, but go after election workers and poll workers. And so my question would be, does this judgment that these two women have obtained really open up the door to start going after Trump, because it is at his behest that this campaign of fear has been inaugurated? So
right. And so, Joe, again, endorse all of the sentiments there. Unpack two or three of them. One, I think at the top of your list there, the impact upon poll workers, right? As we said before, the significance of their role in our election process. There are other Shea Mosses and Ruby Freemans out there across the country. You've identified a couple of them also being threatened with physical violence if they do their jobs. That's the kind of thing that this message coming out of the Giuliani verdict has got to be given to them, spread far and wide. Reason why this morning I'm spending so much time on it, and the notion that you, Joe, and others, I know you will be talking a lot about this to people, that if indeed you continue to behave in that way, You too, again, it's with litigation. I recognize that's not an easy thing to do. The litigation itself has taken a toll upon Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman. Even so, that kind of punitive response from a jury of people out there who looked at this and said, deplorable behavior, abominable behavior, unacceptable behavior, and we're going to punish you for doing it, that certainly is the message. And to get to your second issue, another examination or discussion of potential future cases out there, whether it is Donald Trump, other people saying things that are contrary to the truth and that result in this precisely the kinds of things that Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman alleged in their complaint. Yes, it does provide a template for future cases like that. Does provide the kind of structure that a future piece of litigation, civil, maybe even by the government itself, could be pursued against those people engaged in those threats. Again, it goes back to the fundamental notion we talked about this morning, always chat about, which is First Amendment rights are not inviolate. You do not have the right. You do not have the right to condone violence, to encourage violence, to engage in that kind of threatening behavior. And we saw that again civilly in this case involving Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman. We are seeing it also now in the criminal prosecutions coming out of the Department of Justice as well. If Donald Trump, other people in this continuing campaign continue to suggest that the poll workers in America, other people who are responsible for our elections, are engaging in conduct in which they're not engaging, telling lies about their conduct to their detriment, and the threats of physical violence continue, That too absolutely can be the premise for not only rejection, hopefully, by all of America, should be everybody across the board responding in complete rejection of that kind of conduct, but also future litigation. And judgments like this, the punitive nature of them, the compensatory damages as well, can indeed be a part of that too. And Joe, appreciate so much the comment. We need to make this a part of the coming campaign in 2024 to ensure not only the precision of our electoral process, but the legitimacy of however the vote goes. In our next broadcast, next Saturday, we're going to continue this discussion of the ways in which this unitary executive theory is going to be animating not only this election process, this campaign, but the life and livelihood of all of us here in the United States of America. Join me again next Saturday for that important discussion. Have a good week, everybody. You're the one I can always call.
Tap into what Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley is talking about today. This is 93.5 The Tap.
Online at thetap.fm.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Timeout.
All right. Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Your hometown radio.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.